Hello and welcome to another episode of BFRR, our Bitcoin, Fiat and Rock and Roll podcast that explores the intersection of traditional finance, digital assets and digital currencies. And of course also helps you to understand how digital money and assets will evolve in the future. And today we have another guest episode. It's going to be very exciting. We're going to talk about decentralized autonomous organizations and the many other research topics of our fellow guest today, which is Dan Liebau. So hello, Dan.
Hello. Thank you for having me. It's very exciting. We've been trying to get together for a while, so good that we're here now.
Indeed. Yeah. And next to Dan, there's also our lovely co-host, Stefan, again joining. Hi, Stefan.
Hello, everybody. Glad to be here.
And glad to have you, and also glad that you had the idea to finally get Dan into the podcast. We've been following your research for quite a while. You are a founder, the founder of Lightbulb Capital, a firm based in Hong Kong, but also very active in Singapore. So here, given that I'm also currently based in Singapore, we definitely also wanted to get the APAC focus into the podcast. You are definitely a relevant player here, looking into research in that new emerging field of blockchain adoption in traditional financial markets, but also in the crypto industry in general. The company you founded focuses on all types of innovation and emerging technologies, but I think over the last years, there was a clear focus on blockchain and distributed ledger. Beyond that, you're also a affiliate faculty member at Singapore Management University, where you also teach courses on cryptography, blockchain, digital assets, and DeFi, so decentralized finance. So absolutely great to have you here. And here, from you on your research in this area. But yeah, without further ado, maybe handing over to you, give us a bit of a background maybe, where you come from, what your career path has been, and why you ended up in this research area in DeFi and in blockchain in general.
Sure. So where do I come from? I come from Frankfurt. Very easy to tell that my accent gives away that I come from Germany. But maybe I start very early days of my career. I had to make a choice before taking my first job. I had two job offers. I haven't told this story on any podcast before. One option was to go and work for Compaq, which was a very large computer company back then. We're talking late 90s. And the other one was to go and work for a small company called RTS, Real Time Trading Systems. And that was a company that effectively created software that investment banks would use to trade the markets. And what was special about that company was that they built a sort of a hub and spoke model where out of one system or one front end, you could trade many different markets. And when I spoke to my dad about this discussion, my dad has worked for one company only his entire life. He said, "Of course you're going to go and work for Compaq, right?" And I said, "No, man, this RTS thing, I know it's only 100 people, but it sounds super exciting." And if we were to talk about RTS in today's terms, that would clearly be a fintech type of a company, except for back then the word fintech didn't really exist. And so this first job gave me good insights into sort of the plumbing of financial markets across equities and derivatives markets. And I got really passionate about it. I thought it was really exciting to be very close to the markets and to really see how technology basically enables business. I thought that was super cool. And so after that, I had regular banking IT sort of a career, I suppose. I worked in a few different investment banks across multiple locations, London, Tokyo, Singapore, and eventually ended up on the board of HSBC Securities in Singapore. And there came a time where I'm like, okay, I'm tired of politicking and creating PowerPoint slides. I feel like I'm too young for that. So I said, the worst thing that can happen is if I start something by myself, it folds, and then I go back work for a bank. And that was over 10 years ago now. And so far, nothing folded, which is great. Still going. My company, Lightbulb Capital, started as a firm that created intellectual property to create equity indices. And some partial successes there with selling some IP to New York Stock Exchange. I say partial because eventually the project ended. But pretty early after I started, I think it was 2016 or so, blockchain fell into my lap. One of the professors at SMU said, hey, you should really look into this initial coin offering phenomenon. It's quite exciting. And since then, I have been working on blockchain and everything that's related to it pretty much 100%. Yeah. Started out with obviously participating in a few of these ICOs to get my hands dirty, then launching different courses at SMU to teach the core primitives of blockchain to people. And eventually I got so interested that I thought maybe I should also investigate from an academic research perspective. And that's when the papers started coming out slowly but surely.
And that's when you started to call yourself a pracademic, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of interesting, right? So practitioners will think of me as somebody who is an academic, and then academics will think of me as some guy who came from the world of the industry, right? So I like to be sort of involved in both. I notice that often researchers have very deep theoretical understanding of what they're investigating, but then sometimes you can really tell they've never touched it, you know? And I find that is a little bit of a shame. The first thing I do when I look at some new phenomenon is I set up the wallet and I just log on to the thing and I try it, right? Because I feel like I'm cheating if I'm writing some 30-page document and I've never touched it. So that's one. But then also I think more and more practitioners also like to benefit from the insights of researchers. There's so much content on crypto, but a lot of it, while sometimes very beautifully produced on YouTube, lacks a little bit the substance. And my mission is really to kind of add a little bit of, to add a depth to the topic, right? So that we can take the right decisions and understand the risks, and of course also reap anything that we can get from the opportunities.
Absolutely. And actually, when we first met last year in Singapore in person, I felt in the first 5 minutes that you're very pragmatic and that you actually know what you're talking about, not only from a research perspective, but also by using this stuff, which is very close to my heart. It's a similar approach. I'm not that academic as you are, obviously, but I think both of us try to explain a bit this world, which seems still to be a bit strange to many people in finance, for example, because it's so different setup, so much less control set up around it, and still it works, which must be fascinating for someone who's been longer in finance than myself, for example. And that's why we wanted to bring you up here, Dan. I think that's a very valuable new perspective. I met very few people with that angle on things. And yeah, let's dive into the different areas you've been researching on, and maybe start with the early papers. I think you started with a paper in 2021, or that's one of those at least, where you first discussed the security token offerings and how they might differentiate from ICOs. Maybe where you can take us into that rabbit hole for a moment.
Yeah. So the security token offerings paper is a joint work with Thomas Alambert and Peter Rosenbaum from the Erasmus University. And we started working on this really when the early versions of security tokens appeared in the market. And that happened shortly after the ICO boom sort of ended.
So yeah, we're talking 2018, maybe? 2017?
Yeah, around there. You know, there were really these early experiments where people said, well, the biggest question around town is it a security or is it not a security? And then suddenly people started saying, well, it is a security, and we're going to make it a security, and we're not going to have this ambiguity about whether it is or whether it is not. And basically, I remember we went through a lot of pain to hand collect all of this information about all of these different offerings. I think there were over 100 of them. So all of that we eventually compiled, and we did some analysis about what characteristics basically help getting funding as one of these security token offerings. Where basically, we looked at the primary market, right? Not so much the secondary market. And what's kind of interesting is that if by now it's quite a highly cited article, and we don't really get cited much for any of the analytical work that we did. we mostly get cited because there's a table one in this article that clearly delineates the differences between security tokens and utility tokens. And that's what people pick up on, right? Because eventually this question about whether is it a security, is it not a security, didn't go away. And eventually people wanted more than it is what the SEC says it is, right? And then lots of questions around how we test and all that. So we try to come up with that differentiation. And maybe I just, we don't have to go through the whole table, but I think there's a few things that I wanna kind of highlight. So at that time, we looked as a security token as a digital representation of an investment product. And people buy investment products because you have some sort of expectation of profit. And at least conceptually, utility tokens give you a consumptive right to access a product or service. So you can think of them as a voucher. You can exchange the voucher or the utility token for the service that the platform provides. So eventually, the real point about a utility token is to spend it on the platform. And that's very different from buying it because you have some expectation of profit. Of course, where it all got a little bit blurry is that people misused utility tokens to speculate. Yeah? But that's is on another piece of paper.
Which is still true for the two biggest coins, isn't it? So you can spend Bitcoin, you need to spend it for transactions similar to Ethereum. And still, they have utility, but they are certainly speculated on, which is the whole dilemma from my point of view. If you try to separate things that in this world clearly belong together, actually, so it's an interesting discussion. This won't end soon, I guess.
And in the ICO hype back in 2018, I mean, I remember I was at Frankfurt School Blockchain Center with Philipp Sandner organizing a conference back then, and I was flooded with token projects of all the people that wanted to talk at the conference. And as you said, Ted, what is this token? Yeah, some utility token, whatever. Yeah, you could spend it on the platform for some service. The service was highly questionable. Nobody knew whether you would actually get something. But then maybe to make it more concrete on the security token offering, I do remember, and I looked it up again, I think at least in Germany, the Bitbond token in 2019 was, I think, the first one that then came up and really issued it as a security, right? Where there was a fixed coupon, where even it had an ISIN and so forth. And I think I remember talking to the Radko, for example, and the other team at Bitbond. It was a very lengthy discussion with BaFin, and then ultimately they received allowance or some permission exactly to issue it. But I mean, we're talking very, very early days now without a framework like we currently have with EWPG, so the electronic securities license and regulation in Germany, right? So this was brand new. And there was, again, I remember lots of projections into this market. Oh, and at some time in the future, all securities will be on the blockchain and so forth. So I think, it's a groundwork that you worked on here with this paper, differentiating between the floods of utility tokens and the few security tokens that already emerged back then.
Yeah, interestingly enough, Bitbond is one of the observations that we analyzed in that article as well. I remember, I remember most of them because I had to be very careful when I collected all that data. What's interesting is that security tokens then sort of disappeared, or nobody really cared much about them for a while. And it seems like now we are kind of back looking at security tokens again, albeit in a slightly different definition, right? Now people talk about already existing securities being recorded on top of a blockchain that could include, you know, listed companies like Apple shares or whatever else. Whereas back then we were very focused on the sort of more entrepreneurial side of this whole spectrum. and basically small companies issuing some debt or equity on the blockchain that was not in existence before that. And I think the one thing that is sort of true for both of these types is that it gets really interesting when blockchain is accepted as the sort of ultimate store of securities information. And I think not many jurisdictions around the world are at that level yet. And that's why security tokens today mostly remain, as we defined them back then, digital representations. But towards the end of the paper, we allude to this thing that we call NDS, or native digital securities, which are basically securities that are managed and maintained on top of a blockchain. And I think once we get closer to this NDS concept, then there's lots of opportunity also for traditional finance.
This is a discussion very close to my heart. Sorry, I need to jump in here because I try to frame it like digital native or digital twin, actually. So even if you look at the tokenized money market funds these days, if you look a bit deeper down, so most of them are still digital twins. So they are actually completely managed in the traditional way. And you have just a token representing some part of the whole fund. So obviously the issuer likes to use the old fund with all the history and all the quality that was proven to the market. And then they just tokenize parts of the shares of the fund. Whereas others are digitally native and really try to manage the underlyings even as NFTs in a pool or something like that. And the whole management is much, much more on-chain. So just looking into that asset class, it's very, very interesting to distinguish the little nuances, how this is actually managed and what the law actually allows you to do and how much blockchain native you are, which in the end results very much in the advantages. So we all see these numbers, how much more effective you get if you go on chain with your asset. But I think then some people go just with 5% on chain and the rest is traditional management, which can't unleash 90% improvement, obviously. Yeah. So I think just for our listeners, for me, it's a very important discussion. So beyond utility versus security, even if you have a financial instrument or anything else, you really need to look what's actually tokenized, if any attributes are tokenized, if any corporate actions are brought on chain, et cetera, et cetera. So I think the dream many people usually preach when they are on stage is far away from the reality of tokenization these days, let alone we're missing standards and stuff like that. So I think we have some more years to cover, Manuel, with this topic going forward. And maybe drive you forward to some of the other papers. So last year, you published one that I found quite interesting because also related to some of the work I did in the past. It's called Decentralized Finance Impact on Financial Services and Required DeFi Literacy in 2034. So DeFi literacy is really a nice term. Maybe
let's make it more prominent.
Maybe the end goal, I think a little basic understanding would be fine for the first move. Literacy is I think maybe a bit further down the road, but what motivated you for that paper, and maybe give us some insights? What are the key findings from there?
Yeah. So I had launched a course at SMU on decentralized finance. And eventually I came across this article that tried to do a very similar exercise as the one that you can see in my article on the topic of AI. And I thought, okay, that's kind of interesting. And wouldn't it be useful to have something very similar on DeFi? Because if my hunch is right and DeFi is going to become more important over time, then we should also understand not only whether my hunch is correct, but also whether experts would agree that there are a whole bunch of competencies that are required to deal with this new world where eventually DeFi plays some sort of a role. And what I did next is I basically amended that survey that this other professor from university in Paris had used on the AI topic, and then eventually gave it to first a whole bunch of students, second to some people I knew were working in the DeFi industry, and then third to some fellow researchers. Yeah. And yeah, the article is basically just a summary. In its current form, it's a summary of the answers. I'm actually reworking it right now and trying to make it a little bit more analytical so that we can put it in some journal, because at the minute it lacks a little bit the sort of analytical part. But still quite a few very interesting results, I suppose. The first one is, of course, that while DeFi adoption largely does not exist today in the traditional world of finance, these 109 experts across these three different groups that I mentioned kind of agree that in 10 years or now in 9 years from now, DeFi will be quite relevant. I guess one thing that I also wanted to share is that eventually there were quite a few people taking my class that work with a regulator. So just to preempt the question about, oh, but you only ask people who are really excited about it. No, actually, actually a lot of them come from a background where they are like extremely careful. And, basically their main objective to taking the course is to understand the risks and to see what we have to ban and what we can allow. So I think there's a kind of an important thing to know when one reads through the paper. So at first question was really, okay, does it matter? Does it not matter? Then the second one, okay, how is that all going to materialize, right? And so one of the questions, we basically put forward five different scenarios, and it's a bit of a spectrum from finance as usual, which basically means there's really no significant role for DeFi in 10 years' time at all the way to what we call DeFi revolution, which is like traditional finance just gets replaced and everything is DeFi. And actually, to no surprise, the truth is somewhere in the middle, right? So I think in general, I would always suggest that putting things on top of a blockchain is not always required. And I'm also have come to be a little bit tired with speaking to people who are very religious about that and see that, you know, anything that's not on a blockchain is not correctness. No, it's also not true, you know. There are some valuable services that are perhaps best placed within some intermediary, and that's fine. But then at the same time, there's also some really interesting opportunities that you can realize through the blockchain. It's not always a faster, cheaper, better sort of a technology like AI and others are, but really goes a little bit deeper because you have this opportunity to operate in a trustless fashion, for example, right? You can be your own custodian and so on. So that is, of course, much more important in jurisdictions where there's less trust in the financial system. So that's why when I speak to people in Singapore and Hong Kong, they say, yeah, but, you know, we don't need it. Does it make my transaction cheaper and faster? So, yeah, but, you know, we're not alone in the world. And there are some, I mean, I don't know whether I've mentioned this before, but my dad is from Argentina. In my lifetime, we had two bank runs where basically part of my family got wiped out financially because the bank said, oh, sorry, money's gone. And when you come from that kind of a background, you can understand much more why some people might like sovereignty of their own funds. Yeah. So that is really the one of the key takeaways, that there will be some sort of combination of these two worlds, DeFi and centralized finance. And just quickly to wrap it up, one of the biggest sort of insights of this article was that beyond just understanding what a blockchain is and how to operate a wallet and smart contracts and all of these sort of technical terms, actually it takes much more for a organization to become DeFi literate. Turns out that there's other strategic skills, for example, that are extremely important, because you have to understand how to position yourself as an institution in this new world where DeFi coexists with traditional finance.
Which players like Coinbase already do, if you look what they do together with Morpho when they now integrate Uniswap into their own services. So if you count Coinbase as an institution or not, I would so. It's certainly an innovative one. But yeah, I think if you look at these early movers, they actually follow your advice, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, Coinbase is an interesting example because, of course, they are to some, I mean, they're organized like an institution, but they're also very crypto native in the sense that they only exist because crypto exists. I mean, the name gives it away, right? But so for them, this might come more naturally, but that is something that perhaps other companies really haven't thought about that much, right? So that beyond these sector specific skills, we call them, you also need the right strategic approach. Of course, you need to set yourself up from a technology perspective. You know, we think about all these hacks. Maybe traditional institutions also need to be extra careful with cybersecurity. And of course, there are also a whole bunch of ethical considerations. So much, you know, questionable practices in crypto markets. How do you make sure that you don't participate in that or unwillingly support it and so on? So I think that's all quite an interesting development. Yeah.
Then maybe before we also then build the bridge to the next chapter or the next topic for DAOs, decentralized autonomous organizations, which are all very pure DeFi and pure public blockchain related topics. And this is clearly also where your research lies. I'm still wondering, when you now focused, for example, as per this paper and in discussions with the existing financial services players, do you somehow also look into this? And we are at least known and do follow the developments on private permission blockchains in the regulated financial sector as well. And also, for example, in the last news episode, portrayed a at least to our knowledge and our view, the move away from bank-centric private permission blockchains rather into the shared network layer and potentially in the future even into a public world where you then have some permissioning on the application layer. Did that also, or does that also come across your research, or do you say, look, to me, it doesn't really make sense. I only focus on public permissionless and the DeFi concept, so to say, where there is no control of the underlying infrastructure.
No, I mean, in a way, right? All research that is done on public permissionless blockchains contributes to this convergence in a way. Because if we understand the opportunities and the risks associated with using these platforms, maybe we get more comfortable in doing so, right? Right now, I think one of the biggest obstacles of using public permissionless platforms is that eventually we deal with individuals that we don't know who they are. And I keep this saying like a broken record, but of course, traditional finance is basically based on knowing who you're dealing with. And so here comes this new paradigm where we don't know. And then, you know, how do we deal with this? And my take is you can't really deal with it in a deterministic fashion and say, if there is, you know, the possibility that, let's like kind of slowly move into this DAO topic. Let's say there's a new DAO, and then the DAO has 1 million tokens, and then two of these tokens are held by people in a sanctioned country, maybe in North Korea or somewhere where your institution happens to be very uncomfortable with, and you can't really deal with them, right? Does that then make the entire DAO worthy of being sanctioned as well? So I think in the past, you would say, well, if anyone on a cap table of a particular company is a sanctioned country, then that is already a big problem. And then maybe most people would shy away and say, we can't deal with them. So it's very deterministic. What I'm thinking about more is, well, it should probably be more probabilistic. You can't really look at these types of things in such an absolute way. And what becomes much more important is to understand what really the associated risks are. And how influential can these two token holders with their one token each be if there's 10 million tokens and effectively other people take the decisions, right? There's just one example out of many where I think we need to move on a little bit. Of course, I get super excited about all these new crypto, not new, but in finance, new cryptographic primitives that can be used to establish certain characteristics of a human without giving away their data and so on. So I think it's all one big pot. I do like when people experiment with DeFi concepts in the realm of traditional finance. And I also, you know, one of the favorite articles that I have read in the recent past is that by Katia Malinova and Andreas Park on using DeFi to basically run the US stock market, you know, and what would that do? And eventually what they find, at least in a theoretical basis, is that for one of the years, there's like $15 billion in savings. So there is also opportunities in taking some of that new concepts that are developed in DeFi into the traditional world, which you cannot expect TradFi to only move into the DeFi direction. Sometimes DeFi also has to move into the direction, right?
100% agreed. Yeah, we also talked about this in the latest news episode, where some protocols now include permission pools or, you know, further permissioning on the smart contract level as well. Actually, I think the episode after the episode that we will screen with you, we also have an episode with another interesting guest. I think, Stefan, you're also involved in that interview later today. There's lots of research in how public permissionless infrastructures can be used. So Fabian Scher is going to share more on this as well. Yeah. So I think there's strong movement in this area, because you really recognize that, at least closed loop ecosystems don't really come to the benefits that everybody is talking about with full atomicity, with the composability of smart contracts and so forth. So I think that research is definitely needed. And then eventually also how DAOs could be used in more traditional ecosystems. And this is maybe a good bridge. I mean, you've, over the last years, to my understanding, you've spent a lot of time on a book also on this topic. Maybe you can give us some insights of what the journey looks like to write a book on this complex topic, and why you believe the book is necessary on this journey, on this topic.
So first, I have to give a lot of credit to my co-author, Sandy O. Without her, this book would not be around. The way we decided to write it is we were both quite interested in the concept of a DAO, me more from a perhaps technology and governance perspective, Sandy also more from a, you know, how do humans organize themselves to pursue some goal, and does that always have to be for profit and so on. And so eventually I remember we said, okay, why don't we write a book? We always wanted to write a book about something. And then we thought, oh, maybe the topic is DAOs. And then I said, okay, then if we get a contract, we got to write the book. And soon enough, I managed to convince a publisher. And then we had to write the book. And that's how it all started. So the idea was really, because Sandy is also... has a background in financial services. And we thought we want to very clearly delineate our book from perhaps other books that are out there already on DAOs. And at the time, there were already quite a few of them. So, you know, why do you want to write another one explaining the same things? We thought that was a bit lame. So what were we able to do? We tried to really answer the question that's also baked into the title, right? How finance can interact with these blockchain-based DAOs. Because our hunch was that sooner or later, DAOs would become so relevant in size that some smart banker would want them as a client. And then eventually, maybe it also goes the other way around, and maybe an institution says, oh, you know, the service that this DAO provides is quite interesting. We want to make it accessible to our clients. But then how do we integrate the service offering of the DAO onto our platform? Of course, we're both not legal scholars, so we're very fortunate that we have had the chance to interview four experts, and one of them is an expert lawyer in the field, Hagen Rook. He covers the whole structuring part, and you know how do DAOs today find a way to some sort of legal representation of the entity? Right, that's kind of the critical question, but. Yeah, we thought, okay, how do you give people lay of the land on what's happening in the DAO space? how important are the underlying blockchains and their characteristics that these DAOs operate on? Because as we know by now, not all of these layer one blockchains have the same characteristics, and some may be better at one thing and not so good at the other thing. So we spend a whole chapter going through all these adaptability characteristics, as we call them. Then introduce the governance mechanisms in DAOs. So how do people propose? How does the voting work? What are the different options there? And then we have one chapter where we're really trying to help people categorize these so many different DAOs, right? And we think about it a little bit like the GICS standard. If you remember, MSCI created this standard to put companies into different industries and sectors and so on. So we created a little mini version for that for DAOs, just to help people understand how to categorize these DAOs when they are in front of them. And then we have one entire chapter that talks about risk management, because what we realized is that albeit some of the risks prevail that we know from traditional financial services, there are some new ones, very idiosyncratic ones that perhaps nobody's heard of if they haven't looked at DAOs. So we give a definition, and then we also provide some sort of framework on how to assess.
Before we dive into more detail, which I will do, but maybe you take us one step back. I think it's very important to understand the motivation of people founding a DAO in the first place. What is driving this founding process? How do people get involved with a DAO? Because I think that's very different from a regular company, actually. And then at a certain point, they try to behave like a regular company, or even a company a financial institute wants to deal with. So this evolution from a movement to a DAO to a business partner would be very interesting to hear from your point of view and from your research perspective.
The nice thing about writing a book as compared to writing a paper is that you have a little bit of leeway to speculate. And I'm also going to give you two answers to your questions. One is the answer that everyone wants to hear, which is, you know, a group of like-minded people get together to pursue some common goal, and then they use blockchain to kind of facilitate their decision making and use the tokens to facilitate the voting process and so on. But then there's also another answer. People just want to raise money, you know, and pursue exactly whatever project they want to do and sell their tokens to venture capital firms. And so I guess the truth, if you look at the ecosystem today, is somewhere in the middle, you know? And it's also not static. Some people may say, well, we have this idealistic vision of creating a public digital good, and everyone should be able to access it, and nobody should centrally run it and all that. And then eventually they do run it as a company. I mean, still a DAO, but run it as a company. There are also others where maybe the journey starts the other way around, right? They realize they need to be more organized as a company, because otherwise decision-making as a collective is so slow that they get nothing done. And once they reach a certain level of maturity, they say, okay, now I'm letting go a little bit of the control, and we can, you know, take a little bit more time to take the decisions and get everyone involved. So it's still pretty early, and people are trying to figure out how to best do this. You know, the private limited company has been around for, I don't know, since 1850 something, don't quote me on the numbers, but it's around there. And we have a lot of experience of how to use it and what to use it for and so on. DAOs are a few years old, so we're just trying to find the best way. And not every actor in that ecosystem is a rogue actor, but not every actor is also a good actor, right? So we need to understand that the zoo is very colorful here.
Yeah, one problem that I saw, and I interacted with some of these DAOs. I even once, I think Manu doesn't know, once I got paid by a DAO for doing some work. So I really tried that out 3 or 4 years ago to really engage with these people. But actually, I found it quite hard, because you need to go into these Discord channels and say, hey, I'm Stefan. how are you? I would like to engage with you guys. And then somehow you need to win trust with these strangers, and maybe you get kind of a task or something like that. But from my perspective, it was all about getting attention for a certain amount of time. So you want to have this community. You want. I think most DAOs in the beginning, at least, they want this speculation. They want people to be early movers and maybe profit from the upside of token appreciation or something like that. And I think the big deal is to keep the attention somewhat high, that you don't lose all the interested people from that DAO. And then you have these voting processes you might dive into, where you have the big question. So do you vote every week? Do you vote every month? Do you vote on small decisions or big decisions? And how do you actually organize around that? And how do you prove that everything went out smoothly? I think where many DAOs might have a little problem. That's actually my mental model to think about DAOs a bit from a token holder perspective. But from your research, how do you see DAOs maturing and handling this important problem?
Maybe a few statements to begin with. Very few jurisdictions offer DAOs a legal kind of form to use to be a legal person. That's already quite limiting if you think about it, right? Because while something might work on top of a blockchain without any issues and everything's borderless and all the rest of it, today the world is run by rule of law, and probably that's also a good thing, right? So you have this friction. So then people who start a DAO are inherently challenged because they can't play by the standard rules. And even the ones that want to be very observant of rules and laws and regulations are challenged in that way, right? So you also have to cut them a little bit of slack, because that is not an easy thing to do, right? It's much easier to incorporate a private limited and sell some product to somebody. I would by now distinguish sort of different types of actors in the DAO space. One that is very focused on this community idea, really, and that is super passionate about this concept of getting together with like-minded people and then getting something done on their path to achieve their mission. And then others who are really profit-oriented. I'm not saying that the passionate ones about the mutual goal cannot be profit-oriented, but I think there is also a large group of people in the DAO space that are really only caring about their token price and how to eventually cash out from that whole project. Right? And to tell these two apart is sometimes also not so difficult. So if an institution would want to engage with a DAO, you know, one thing is probably a little bit underrepresented in the book is to also try and get a feeling of who you're dealing with, right? There will be some representatives or somebody appointed by the DAO that needs to deal with other people on the path to integration with a bank, for example. Who are they? What do they do? How do they come across? These things are, I think, also quite important.
I think social engineering always helps a lot judging these projects, to really look at prominent figures from their community. How do they behave? How do they interact? Podcasts are actually one of my favorite resources to do some of the research. Who am I dealing with? Which obviously is not enough for institutions. So you need to go much deeper. But maybe going to this voting aspect, which I found very critical, actually, because sometimes in these votings, the whole direction of this DAO company, if you want, takes a different path. So if you share some profit for your token holders, for example, or if you raise the fees, let's talk about some of these DEXs who are usually organized as DAOs. So sometimes they vote about actually getting a cut out of the trading fees or something like that. So really critical decisions about the profitability and also the longevity of this whole enterprise, if you will. Did you go down that route and analyze these voting processes and how democratic they actually work, if there might be collusion behind the scenes? How long do they take? How often do they take place? Any research ideas that angle?
So the good news is that since all of that stuff happens on the blockchain, it attracts a lot of academic researchers from all walks of life, whether it's computer science, econ, finance, And they're like, okay, there's this data pot that we can exploit. So I think if you would search for DAO research, you know, there's an increasing number of articles. I think some sort of common findings, I would say, is that often very few wallets control enough voting power to swing votes in whatever direction. So you have that concentration in voting power. There's an article by Xiaotong Sun and co-authors that look at MakerDAO, for example. They find this centralization tendency. We have another working paper out now on vote delegation, in particular on Uniswap. We find the same thing for the period that we analyze. You know, the two largest voters basically command a lot of the voting power. So that's one tendency. I think what's perhaps important to kind of look ahead, right, is to set yourself up and understand how some of this concentration or centralization develops over time. So we already said that perhaps in the very early days, it's very much needed to be centralized to make progress. But then over time, if you call yourself a DAO, you also want to be a little bit more decentralized. So can you show that you go from centralized to decentralized? And there are many metrics, including one new one that I don't recall the name, but I met the researcher last year in Switzerland, very smart researcher. If you were to monitor one or multiple of these metrics over time, and you see that the trend is, it kind of goes in the right direction, right? For example, you look at a Herfindahl Hirschman index and you see it trends down. Down means less concentration. Then that's good, right? And if you care about decentralization, actually, that's what you should expect. If that thing goes the other way around, then there's even more questions, right? Because the more mature the organization gets, the more decentralized it has to get. There's very little reason to centralize it after you launched. So that could be one interesting tool to also assess how centralization pans out in the DAO space.
I sometimes get the feeling that it goes the other way around, that it actually starts quite decentralized and gets more centralized over time because some venture capitalist is joining the game, or also this vote delegation. Maybe you go just one step further. What does that actually mean, and why? Why would I delegate my vote when I own these governance tokens?
Good news is that for Uniswap, which is the largest decentralized exchange out there, I think, in the Ethereum ecosystem at least, the HHI index trends this way. So it goes from high to low, which is good. It's still too high in my mind, but it's still trending in the right direction. Don't forget that venture capitalists usually get involved before the token is even tradable. So I don't think that they would come in after that. So the decentralization, well, all things equal, should come down. So delegation. There are a few reasons why you might want to choose to delegate your voting power to somebody else. First, you don't really care. You care enough that you want the thing to be in good hands because you think if it's in good hands, then the token price will go up. But you don't want to deal with participating in the voting and reading all of these proposals and studying them and reading the feedback to the proposals to then eventually the tweaked version that eventually gets approved and then do audit on the smart contract that executes the code. You don't want to do all that. So then just say, okay, I know that there are a bunch of people who do this all day long. I just trust them, right? It's actually not too dissimilar to what happens in many countries today, where you don't have a direct vote, but you just elect somebody to represent you in that sense. The other reason could be that you are aware of the fact that there might be some powerful actors and you want to give other actors that are not yet so powerful a voice. And even if you only have two tokens, if many people do that, you get eventually to a more decentralized sort of a setup. And that's also one thing that we looked into in this last paper, where common sense would dictate that there's this idea of skin in the game. So if somebody already has a lot of their own token, then maybe they can also attract more delegated votes. But we actually find the opposite, which also kind of supports what I just tried to explain. Now, people are appreciative of this idea of decentralization, therefore spread their voting power to other actors. And you know, we have one kind of chart in the paper, which is very interesting. So the tokens that the voting power that people control due to owning uni tokens is really, really orders of magnitude smaller than the delegated voting power, you know, which is in itself interesting. Another reason why you might delegate, and that is not so obvious, is that you don't know that you've delegated. So one interesting thing that we came across when we did some hands-on action research, also part of this article, is that voting rights remain delegated even when tokens move from one wallet to the next. So let's just say I think Stefan is a very good delegate and I delegate some voting power to him. And then I sell my tokens that I had in my wallet to Manuel, unless Manuel claims then the voting right and assigns that voting right to either himself or somebody of his choosing, the voting power will remain with Stefan. And I never quite understand whether that is a feature or a bug. But if you think about the implications, it's quite meaningful, yeah? Because thousands and thousands of tokens change hands on centralized exchanges every single day. And while exchanges themselves have agreed to not touch that voting power and not get involved here, you could easily see how somebody who's trying to build up some voting power in that ecosystem could benefit from that, right? Because people are too lazy to say, okay, now I purchased these 5 tokens and I'm going to wire them out into my wallet and I'm going to claim the voting right and I need to sign at least 2 transactions, right, to do that. Who does that, right? Lots of people, again, are in for the speculation only, and then that also creates a little bit of a tech surface in my mind.
And with all those difficulties, Dan, where do you currently see a big added value by these new governance structures? So you mentioned, for example, Uniswap or also the MakerDAO as an example where things eventually go right. Why do they go right? And what is the benefit of organizing those concepts under a DAO structure?
Yeah. I mean, nothing's perfect, but I do think there is some value in thinking about what a public good should be in the digital context or in the online context. So in the past, you know, there's like fishing grounds or, I don't know, woods or whatever that are governed in a sort of a community base. And, you know, Elinor Ostrom got a Nobel Prize to show how that works better than if a company was appointed to do the same job. Now we're in a world where there are computers and there's the online world. Is there room for some sort of public good in the digital world and on top of a blockchain? You could argue, absolutely. And one of the important things is, of course, if everyone offers everything as a service in the form of a utility token, the function of trading one for the other or exchanging some sort of stablecoin for some service that you're interested in, maybe that is the closest thing to a public good conceptually, right? So I think there is a benefit there that these public good-like services are organized as a DAO, but that conversely also means that not all services need to be provided by a DAO. I always think of custody services in digital asset, right? This whole self-custody idea, I think, is quite scary if I think about it as a user. I want an intermediary. I don't want to have that full responsibility to sign a transaction and then eventually sign my wealth away because somebody smuggled some rogue smart contract code into my browser. You know, I don't want to deal with that risk. I want somebody to do that for me, and I'm happy to pay for that. So does a company that provides custody services necessarily need to be a DAO? No, I don't think so. You know, so it really depends on the business model and what kind of service we're really dealing with.
It's interesting because I on the one hand side, I agree with the public good approach, but then reality strikes back over time, and DAOs need to manage their treasuries. They need to grow up. They need to mature, and in the end, they more or less behave like a company because they point out certain people with certain responsibilities. They are representing the company. They are dealing with jobs. So sometimes I have the feeling when you look at these DAO guys, some of them never have worked in a normal company. And actually, it's not as bad as they imagined to work in a normal company. And in the end, I got the feeling that they deal with very similar problems, that the people that they selected might not be fit for the role. So sometimes I'm laughing about that a bit. Working for a nice company, actually, I think you can find a place there too. And it's a bit black versus white sometimes. And the reality is usually shades of gray.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's where I would want to position myself as well here. I mean, not everything has to be a DAO, but some things can be a DAO. Yesterday evening, I was on a call with some DAO-focused researchers who themselves are organized as a DAO. And you know, all of these people do not... I don't think that this DAO even has a token. It's very informal at this stage. There are people from all over the world. They all introduce themselves, and they are super passionate about the topic, and they're just trying to figure out how to do things, right? So let's
not
disregard...
Which is very cool, by the way.
Yeah, it's very cool.
Sorry.
And these things also exist, right? So that is also something we have to remember.
Is there a way forward that you can imagine where there are some hybrid forms, right? Where there's some centralized organizational structure, but then potentially for some votes, it is delegated to token holders because you want to include additional stakeholders beyond the shareholders, for example, that are represented by a board or by other structures.
Yeah. I mean, the whole bunch of experimental activities in that space already. I think one of the examples that we mention in the book as well is that of a very large Japanese insurance company. And they obviously have humongous sales force of agents that sell their insurance. And this sales force has interests, right? And they need to organize themselves somehow. So they were thinking, okay, can we make use of this concept of a DAO to sort of help them organize themselves and find representation and so on? So I think those things are happening. I think there was another example I was just thinking about, but now it slipped my mind. But I think it's probably fair to say that both sides are moving towards each other in a way, right? So traditional firms may move a little bit more in the DAO direction, and then DAOs are also trying to think about, okay, can we push for some legal entity wrapper or representation in our jurisdictions and so on? So I think that's also something that is eventually converging. And then we're all back in the sort of native digital securities space, where eventually we hope that governments also accept ultimate beneficial owner records and so on that are stored on top of a blockchain.
I guess we come back to the original thing, that you need people to be motivated to be actually active in a DAO. And you see that also with the big ones, that they create sub-DAOs with like-minded people. So I think MakerDAO has many different sub-DAOs who care for a certain aspect. I think this has the big advantage that you have to deal with like-minded people with maybe even a similar background. And that motivates you back into this, because you need to be self-driven in order to engage with that, because some of the work is not compensated at all with money. So it needs to be fun at a certain point in time. So I wouldn't underestimate that aspect. It's not, I think for many people, it's not usual work unless you are voted into some special role that gets compensated with real money or tokens. So I think that's the complex thing in that, how to keep people motivated, how to select the right people with the right background and the right credibility, which makes it complicated, for example, for financial players to interact with them.
Yeah, looking at the time, an hour is passing by very quickly when you are discussing interesting stuff. Dan, that was very insightful. Thanks a lot. Is there any preferred way how people or listeners can reach out to you? I suppose LinkedIn, X, you are there. Yeah.
LinkedIn is good. I'm a complete X failure. I don't know how people do it, but LinkedIn is easier for me. Maybe it's a function of my age. So LinkedIn is probably the best. There's also danielliebau.org. I set up a website recently. Then email is there as well. If anyone wants to reach out, happy to help and expand on everything that we discussed today.
Yeah, very good. Happy to have those insights and have you representing your views here. Very insightful. Thanks, Stefan, also for tuning in and all your interesting questions and content. I hope you all liked it, dear listeners. So make sure to rate the episode on your favorite podcast catcher and tell everybody about it. And yeah, thanks for tuning in. Thanks both.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you for having us.
The views expressed are solely the personal opinions of the hosts and are provided for informational purposes only. This podcast does not offer financial or investment advice. Always conduct your own research and make well-informed decisions before investing. Please be aware that the hosts and guests may hold cryptocurrencies or digital assets discussed in this episode.